In Indian-administered Kashmir held in eight phases have come to an end. The voting process has remained by and large peaceful amid stringent security measures. After the revocation of Kashmir's special status, regional political parties had refused to participate in the electoral process as a sign of protest against India's decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomous status. That resulted in the strengthening of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in the Muslim-majority region. However, this time, the regional parties formed an alliance to take part in the local elections. Compared to the past, a large number of people came forth to cast their ballots, and many of them told Press TV that their aim is to keep the BJP away from Kashmir's grassroots.
Since the BJP came to power in India, it started taking decisions against minorities. The BJP has taken Kashmir's autonomy, Kashmiris' jobs, and now they are eyeing land. They don't care about the people of Kashmir. We came to cast our votes against those people who only aim to destroy Kashmir's ethnicity in the name of mainstreaming Kashmir.
More and more people in Kashmir have developed skepticism on the overall electoral process after scores of video interviews of the District Development Council or DDC candidates started circulating on social media. A number of candidates have no idea what positions they are running for in the local administration, and even worse, some have no idea what DDC means.
Kashmir, man.
In order for votes to be equally distributed, the Election Commission has accepted nominations from all sorts of people. There is no set prerequisite for candidates. I wonder who they are empowering. How can an uneducated person with no idea of economy, finance and politics seek equal rights and development for me? Basically, they do not need educated people. They want stooges who will implement what the Indian government will decide for us, without thinking about people's interests.
This is the first time that DDC elections are being held. Members of the DDC are expected to prepare and approve district plans and expenditure schemes, which will replace the district planning and development boards in all districts across the region. Earlier, district development boards looked after the planning, approval or implementation of centrally sponsored schemes. The result of the eight-phase elections will be announced on December 22nd. Apparently, the elections in Kashmir have paved the way for other electoral processes in the volatile region. However, many say this ballot has made the people of Kashmir politically aware of the fact that New Delhi is trying to thrust such electoral processes in order to create an impression that normalcy has taken hold after it stripped Kashmir of its autonomy. Actually, without building trust and bridging the gaps. Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. دين الإسلام ديني والعظم غير ديني محمد إلي هديني.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. we are going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Tawbit, let me ask you this question regarding the meat. You know, as long as we live in or under Islamic government, it's kind of, let's say, favor that Muslims, in fact, can live with. And they can make sure that, for example, this kind of meat, is, which is served in the restaurant, must be according to the or slaughtered according to the Islamic laws and Sharia, right?
Yes.
But when we are not living under that kind of condition, we are living in the Western countries, you cannot make sure that this meat, where it is coming from, or whether it has been in fact slaughtered legitimately according to the rules of Islam, right?
Yes.
So if you cannot verify this, that this kind of edible animal's meat is, let's say, legitimately or ritually slaughtered according to the rules of Islamic laws, then what can we do? Can we still eat that meat and food?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, to make things easy for Muslims, Islam has said as long as you buy meat from the Muslim market, you should treat it as halal.
Mm-hmm.
And it may in fact be haram, but we are not supposed to verify, to investigate whether the meat has been, whether the meat comes from an animal which is essentially pure.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. like the meat of cows slaughtered according to Islamic law, we yes. have no obligation to
investigate.
So that's why we see Islam is so an easy religion, and it aims to make things easy for us. When it comes to meat imported from non-Muslim countries, we should we have to check whether the meat has been imported by a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
a Muslim. Who is that Muslim? Is he a carefree Muslim? Is he a Muslim by name? Maybe he is nominally a Muslim, but he is not very
a
much
practicing Muslim.
He is not a practicing Muslim. He must have just used the tag halal.
Mm-hmm.
That tag which is used does not make the meat halal. Okay,
mm-hmm.
The same tag may be in the West, in European country, the tag is used. That tag cannot be considered as an excuse for Muslims to consider the meat halal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very important point. Now, if someone is a trustworthy Muslim and he is importing meat from a given country, and we know that he is a practicing Muslim, he is someone who takes care of Islamic laws and rules, so we can trust him and consider the meat, the imported meat, as halal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if you are living in the West, because we are speaking to people, our audience usually they come from the West, they live in the West, and they are the listeners. Those Muslims who buy meat from a halal store, it's not permissible to use the meat which is considered, which is tagged as halal, or the meat which is sold in a halal, let's say,
supermarket.
That doesn't make it halal, of course. You have to investigate. You have to maybe use the phone call to call the slaughterhouse and check whether the meat comes from an animal which is slaughtered according to Islamic law. There are many conditions that must be met. For example, first of all, the person who slaughters the animal must
mm-hmm.
be Muslim. The animal should be slaughtered in the direction of Qibla.
Yes.
And then the person who recites, who
Bismillah.
Slaughters the animal
yes.
must recite Takbir, God's name.
Yes.
Okay. And there are other conditions, like, for example, the four arteries must
mm-hmm.
be cut. And these are some of the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then whether the animal, let's say, is stand or not. Okay. And if it's stand, is it still alive or not? Because some animals may die before it is slaughtered. It's a possibility. Okay.
Yes.
So these are the conditions which must be fulfilled. Now, in some non-Muslim countries, we see that there are some slaughterhouses. There is not a Muslim individual handling the machine. There is actually a video, a tape recorder that constantly
mm-hmm.
and continuously recite Allahu Akbar or God's name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not sufficient according to Shia Islam. According
mm-hmm.
to the school of Ahlul Bayt, it's not sufficient to light a tape recorder or to play a tape recorder continuously saying Allahu Akbar. That's not sufficient. This could be sufficient according to some Sunni schools, but we are Shias and we must abide by the Shia laws. So the tape recorder is not sufficient. It is necessary, it is essential that a Shia Muslim or a Sunni Muslim, even, it doesn't make any difference,
mm-hmm.
should directly get involved in slaughtering an animal. And if an animal is slaughtered by a machine, the Muslim individual should handle the machine, should operate it, and should constantly recite takbir, even though he might be saying one takbir for two animals, for two chickens.
I see.
Yes.
You mean it doesn't really matter if the machine, in fact, it slaughters the animals, like the chickens, for example, or the sheep.
Yes.
But like a mass slaughtering machine.
Yes.
Does it really matter? I mean, like, if as long as you said, the operator is a Muslim.
Is Muslim and he recites takbir, the animal is slaughtered in the the direction of Qibla, and the food.
And it doesn't matter if the animal is slaughtered individually, like they're mass slaughtered. I've seen the machines, in fact, where you can see that, for example, of course, I'm talking about the Western countries.
Yes.
Machinery where a lot of chickens, in fact, are dipped in the water. They basically suffocate.
That's not acceptable.
Yeah,
that's
That's not the legitimate way of slaughtering according to the rules of Islam. But what I'm asking is that if the machines, in fact, kill or slaughter the animals, but according to the Islamic
law, are slaughtered one by one. Mass killing means killing all of them at and one go, in an instant.
Yes.
That's not done anywhere. I think so.
Uh-huh.
The animals are slaughtered one by one. Like I have been to a slaughterhouse.
Yes.
And I saw that sheep are slaughtered one after another. Chickens are slaughtered one after another. They are first stunned. Even in the Islamic Republic of Iran,
yes,
we see that chickens are first stunned. And then there are two or three people standing, and they are using their knives, cutting the throat of those chickens, and meeting all the requirements that are essential.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
How about the non-animal food or edible products, such as chocolates, chewing gums, cookies, and whatnot, are they basically ritually edible? We know that they're not coming from the meat family, all right? They're not meat products.
Yes.
They're non-meat products, let's call them, all right? If they're imported from non-Muslim countries,
yes,
Are we allowed to eat them as Muslims?
Of course, we are allowed to consume them, and because they are chocolates, they are cookies, biscuits. Okay, as long as we do not know that they contain some impure ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, or they contain or some essentially haram or forbidden ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, if those things have, let's say, pork ingredients.
Yes.
Or if they are cooked, with something with animal fat. Animal fat.
Yes.
And we know that the animal fat, the fat comes from pork.
Yes.
It's not permissible to eat them. But if we know that, but if we have no knowledge of these things, and we know that they are biscuits imported from a non-Muslim country, we can consume them without having to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course we have no obligation. No, it's not actually mandatory for us to.
But we
check.
All know that, for example, biscuits, in fact, are cooked, or one of the ingredients used in biscuits must be eggs. And if the eggs come from other animals rather than chickens, which are not considered to be legitimately halal,
then
do we have to investigate? Because we know, out of the common sense.
Yes, but probably in 90 out of 100 cases, we are sure that the eggs
come from the chicken.
Come from the chicken.
I see.
So the eggs are not. They are. Halal.
Uh-huh.
We don't give a pay heed to that very minute possibility.
I see.
Small, very minor possibility.
Thank you very much, Sheikh
Javid.
That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A recent report by the rights group stated that all Moderna's COVID-19 vaccines and 96% of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine doses have been secured by rich countries, including Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is currently being administered in Canada, while Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Moderna's vaccine would be used in more remote locations in the country once it secures the necessary regulatory approvals. Stephen Coburn, head of economic and social justice at Amnesty International, said Canada is a country that's ordered the most vaccines per person in the world, adding, if all the vaccines that they've ordered are proven to be safe and effective, it would be enough vaccines to immunize the population five times over. Coburn said, with pharmaceutical companies having a finite capacity to produce vaccines, richer countries earmarking so many in advance can create a global shortage of supply. We've prepared for you an article written by Yasmin Hassan under the heading, Is Canada's Me First COVID Vaccine Policy Hurting Other Nations? The article has been taken from the AlJazeera.com website. Please stay with us for more of Yasmin Hassan's article. Frontline healthcare workers and residents of long-term care homes received the first COVID-19 vaccines in Canada recently, marking what officials said is the beginning of the end of the pandemic that brought the world to a halt. But as people in some parts of the world breathe a sigh of relief, others will not be able to join in the collective jubilation for months, if not years, to come. Stephen Coburn, head of economic and social justice at Amnesty International, said that is because countries including Canada have hoarded the majority of the vaccines. A recent report by the rights group stated that all of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccines and 96% of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine doses have been secured by rich countries, including Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is currently being administered in Canada, while Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Moderna's vaccine would be used in more remote locations in the country once it secures the necessary regulatory approvals. Coburn told Al Jazeera, Canada is a country that's ordered the most vaccines per person in the world. If all the vaccines that they've ordered are proven to be safe and effective, it will mean enough vaccines to immunize the entire population of Canada five times over. Coburn said, with pharmaceutical companies having a finite capacity to produce vaccines, richer countries earmarking so many in advance can create a global shortage of supply. by extension, that could complicate international efforts to ensure the equal distribution of vaccine shots, such as COVAX, a global initiative launched by the World Health Organization, WHO, in April of this year, to ensure safe and effective COVID-19 vaccines are distributed evenly between nations. Stephen Coburn said, "Many countries have seen the vaccine, understandably so, as their way out of this crisis, and it's been a race," adding, "Rather than work together, we've had a me-first attitude in many countries, and there's been a lack of multilateralism and global coordination in the world. An equitable vaccine and drug distribution has been an issue for many years." Dr. Katarina Perahodov, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Amsterdam and fellow at the World Health Organization Collaborating Center in Health Promotion at the University of Toronto in Canada, said, "That is because drug development is driven by the market." She told Al Jazeera, "In the last 2 decades, we've seen a decline in the number of vaccine developers and producers globally, and that further concentrates and privatizes vaccine development and manufacturing capacity around the world. The system sets up richer countries to receive the first vaccines faster because they have the money to stand at the front of the line and buy vaccines from the private companies that created them." In other words, a profit-driven model of drug development will see scarce supplies go to the highest bidder, even though pandemic recovery hinges on international cooperation and the equitable global distribution of vaccines. However, Dr. Katarina Perahodov said that in the current circumstances, it is understandable that countries will be trying to get themselves out of the crisis first. She said, "Securing a big piece of the world's limited vaccine supply inevitably leaves less room for others. And that decision also has important human rights and ethical implications for countries like Canada to assist lower-resource nations to access these medicines." Justin Trudeau recently told reporters Canada, home to just 38 million people, expects to receive 168 million doses of the Moderna vaccine and as many as 249 million Pfizer-BioNTech doses before the end of the year. The country has reported more than 481,000 cases of COVID-19 since the pandemic began and over 13,000 deaths linked to the novel coronavirus. Karina Gould, Canada's Minister of International Development, claimed Canada has been among the donors to international initiatives such as COVAX, a World Health Organization-led effort that brings together world leaders, philanthropists, and others to accelerate the development of COVID-19 tests, treatments, and vaccines. Karina Gould said, "The idea is that if you're a self-financing country or a low-income country, that within the first year that the vaccine is available, you will receive enough doses for 20% of your population." But Stephen Coburn at Amnesty International insisted that leaders need to see the battle against COVID-19 as a collective one. He said, "I understand that governments are under pressure by their populations, as well as to make sure that they get vaccines. We would argue that is unfair and also short-sighted. If you only vaccinate a portion of the world, you still can't really open up global trade or global travel, and you risk the virus coming back into your own country."
Thank you. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On the news line. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 20, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Iran's army chief, Major General Mousavi, said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh last month. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
There's no coincidence because the conservative administration was in power at that time with the prime minister as Stephen Harper, and he was a pro-Zionist, pro-American type of politician. So whatever the Zionist lobbies wanted in Canada, he would work to implement that. Unfortunately, that the West has this double standard and hypocrisy that they use these groups to their benefit when they feel bankrupt.
Since removing its decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. In September 2012, then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said Washington was expunging the MKO from its list of designated terror organizations. The decision came after intense lobbying backed by prominent U.S. officials that included James Woolsey and Porter J. Goss, former CIA directors, Louis J. Free, the former FBI director, President George W. Bush's Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, and Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and President Obama's first National Security Advisor, General James Jones. Many of the U.S. officials had been paid between $15,000 to $30,000 to deliver speeches to the group, as well as travel expenses to attend lavish rallies in Paris. Former governor of Pennsylvania, Edward Rendell, said in 2012 that he had been paid a total of $150,000 to $160,000. In 2016 and 2017, Saudi Arabia's former spy chief, Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, attended MKO meetings in Paris. Advanced with God's blessings, Ben Faisal said in a speech in the 2016 meeting, wishing the terrorists success in attempting, quote, regime change in Iran.
But this is hypocrisy because even the governments that come, I mean, the officials from different systems, such as the Saudi regime, you know, last year, a popular person from the Saudi regime came and said that he was in support of changing the system in Iran and bringing democracy, where we already know that Saudi Arabia is the furthest country from democracy. So how could somebody be supporting democracy when his own system itself is far away from democracy?
In 2018, another meeting in Paris attracted Rudy Giuliani, personal attorney to U.S. President Donald Trump, and Stephen Harper, a former Prime Minister of Canada. Pulitzer Prize winner Seymour Hersh reported in 2012 that a number of MKO members were secretly trained by the United States Joint Special Operations Command At the Department of Energy's Nevada National Security Site, a secretive training facility northwest of Las Vegas. The report was followed by another revelation in 2018 that the terrorists were receiving funds through Saudi smuggling networks and Saudi-linked black market sales to continue their subversive agenda. But what does this say about MKO supporters, except that they have become so desperate in their subversive attempts in Iran that they have turned to a cult group they once blacklisted as a terror organization?
The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits continue to surge at unprecedented levels. Just last week, another 885,000 people filed for first-time unemployment. This is the highest level in the past 3 months. Since the start of the pandemic, more people have lost their jobs and incomes and have become dependent on assistance. Overall, about 20.65 million people are receiving unemployment benefits of some kind since the coronavirus pandemic started in the U.S. The loss of income made millions of American families food insecure. Throughout the pandemic, food banks and pantries have provided millions of Americans with much-needed food. Although hunger is not new in America, the pandemic has had a major impact. Food insecurity has become a widespread national issue, sparing not even some of the wealthier regions. A recent survey shows that 1 in 8 Americans reported that they sometimes, or often, did not have enough food. Overall, food insecurity has doubled since last year, reaching the highest level since 1998. Before the pandemic, the majority of the food bank's clients were the elderly and the underemployed. But there has been a recent influx of service workers who have been disproportionately hit by the COVID-19 crisis. Food insecurity rates spiked at the end of March, when pandemic lockdowns made the U.S. economy stumble. People from Alaska to Georgia are turning to food distribution centers to pick up free groceries. Activists say that food banks are under extra pressure ahead of the upcoming holidays, as requests have skyrocketed. They say that millions of Americans are barely making ends meet and need help to feed their families. Moreover, data by the U.S. Census Bureau indicate that more Americans are going hungry than at any point during the COVID-19 pandemic. The overall U.S. unemployment rate is currently 6.7%, which, while better than previous months, still means that 10 million pre-pandemic jobs have been lost. Economists have said that the jobs that have not returned by this point will be the hardest to claw back, because they are concentrated in the industries most affected by virus containment measures, like leisure, travel, and hospitality. This means that employment gains that people saw during Trump's presidency may not continue at the same pace under Biden. That is because prolonged unemployment, especially in a weak labor market, can be harder to fix. Analysts say that people who have been unemployed for 6 months or more are about twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as to find employment. Moreover, the longer a person is out of work, the less consumer purchasing they do, which further slows economic growth. Data shows that long-term unemployment as a share of unemployment is growing fast across America. In October, 3.6 million of the 11 million unemployed Americans had been out of work for 6 months or longer. That is a ratio not seen since mid-2014, when Biden was the country's vice president. The continuing unemployment crisis has led economists to become increasingly pessimistic about when the country might return to pre-pandemic levels. Business and academic economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal in April predicted the labor market would recover by the year 2022. But when surveyed again in October, 55% had extended their recovery forecast to the year 2023 or later. In the meantime, there are those who believe the mass vaccination can make real change, but it could be months until the jabs are widely distributed.
Until a certain proportion within the population is not immunized, the impact of the vaccine cannot be visible. For instance, we have to vaccinate at least 70 out of 100 people to achieve the herd immunity. At that point, we will start seeing the benefit of the vaccine in breaking the transmission. Although the U.S. has urged to have 100 million doses in the first quarter of 2021, but even if that is started, what we're looking is that August, September would be the time when we will have the herd immunity in the United States. At that point, we will start seeing positive impact on. But before that, it is unfortunate, very grim situation.
As the world advances in its technological capabilities, so too then does the way in which various countries across the world need to protect its assets, particularly when it comes to data, information, and national security through the medium of computer-based hosts. The US has recently stated that it's become victim to yet another highly sophisticated cyber attack on its infrastructure, in particular with the attack aimed at multiple ministries across the US government. And more worryingly for the US, it seems that although discovered, the attack is still ongoing. Some of the departments have come out and announced that their systems have been breached at the Departments of Energy, the Treasury, and the Department of Commerce. At this stage, it's not clear which other departments have been hacked into, although there are reports that the National Nuclear Security Administration, which maintains the country's nuclear stockpile, has also been broken into. The US authorities have yet to admit that other more sensitive departments have also been targeted. The hacking appears to have started in March, targeting the Texas-based network security firm SolarWinds via their so-called Orion software, which was incidentally used by a host of US federal agencies and departments. It's unknown at this point as to just how serious the breaches have been, how much information has been obtained by the hackers, or what kind of information has been taken. But what is known is that some 18,000 people have uploaded the SolarWinds Orion update, loaded with the software, allowing the hackers in via the back door, a highly embarrassing situation for the US government. So does this incident suggest that the US is lagging behind in their capability when it comes to preventing such hacks? For a start, the US Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, has suffered a huge blow to their reputation, raising the speculation as to whether the US are becoming weaker or whether the hackers are simply getting smarter.
I think it's the latter. I think the hacking abilities have improved. And there's been a proliferation of a lot of private hacking entities, companies, corporations, et cetera, which have proved quite adept when it comes to penetrating the most tightly guarded software facilities.
The priority for the US will now involve securing their cyberspace infrastructure and making sure that the damage done does not cost them too dearly. With more and more states becoming ever more aware and capable when it comes to cyber warfare, the US now have to contemplate who the authors of the cyber attack were and why they targeted the US in the way they did. After all, the US have a host of adversaries around the world. In typical fashion, the Americans have already pointed their fingers towards Moscow as the perpetrators of the attack, claiming that the technology can only have come from a sophisticated source, backed by a state. However, the Russians have nonsensed the US claims, stating they do not participate in such acts. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has been quoted as stating that the US should not put the blame of their own failures on Russia, claiming that Russia will not stand by and be blamed for anything and everything the US decides it needs a scapegoat for. With Russia being blamed then, could the future of warfare between sovereign states turn to cyber-based attacks and hence see an elevation in frequency and sophistication in the near future?
Yeah, this is a big problem. I mean, attribution is very difficult. It's very difficult to figure out who is behind these attacks. And that's a big problem, because if there's a major disruption, a major attack in the U.S., and say, you know, power grids go out or emergency services are cut off or whatever, there'll be enormous pressure to retaliate. And therefore, the U.S. could respond in kind to Russia only to discover months later that it really wasn't Russia at all.
With the White House and Donald Trump remaining eerily silent so far, the U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has come forward, stating that significant funds will be generated during his presidency to disrupt and deter adversaries in targeting the U.S. through cyber attacks. With cyber warfare fast becoming the new norm in global security issues, it seems that across the world, states need to both prepare themselves for cyber attacks and use the technique to secure an advantage over others, as fifth-generation warfare fast becomes a new tool of the state. But more worryingly, for all, is the notion that individuals and lone actors are also capable, and in fact more dangerous when it comes to security breaches in national security, through the medium of cyber attacks. So next time you're on your computer, be careful. You have been warned.
The issue of human rights once again caused controversy and deep divisions at the United Nations General Assembly this week. The Assembly passed a resolution on the human rights situation in Iran on Wednesday. The document was critical of the use of death penalty and prison conditions, among other alleged rights violations in Iran. The resolution was proposed by the Canadian government and supported by the United States and mostly its regional and Western allies. The UN General Assembly has 193 members, but the resolution against Iran was passed with 82 votes in favor. That's significantly less than half of the number of member states. The Iranian government was quick to condemn the move, saying an anti-Iran bloc used the General Assembly on Wednesday as a tool to impose pressure on Iran. Tehran argues that the resolution has exposed sheer hypocrisy regarding human rights because many of the proponents of the anti-Iran move have either notorious records of human rights violations or choose to remain silent on such violations in some parts of the world. Tehran said the states behind the resolution are under the influence of American bullying. The Iranian government says those states have turned a blind eye to U.S. economic terrorism against the Iranians at the time of a worsening pandemic, that are acting as Washington's accomplices instead of condemning its illegal and inhumane sanctions that have hurt ordinary Iranians. This week, the United States voted against, while European states and Canada abstained from voting on an important Russia-drafted document. The initiative was titled Combating Glorification of Nazism, Neo-Nazism, and Other Practices that Contribute to Fueling Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. The Russian draft of resolution was passed with 130 votes in favor, despite the campaign by the U.S. and its allies. The Russian initiative is aimed at condemning and combating some of the most notorious forms of violation of human rights in the world, like Nazism and racism. So why did the U.S. and its allies choose to stand against or be different towards the resolution? Was it because the text was drafted by Russia, which is a rival in the world stage? Critics say what happened this week at the UN General Assembly further exposed double standards adopted by the U.S. and its allies regarding human rights around the world.
Ultimately, anything they do in the name of human rights always is underpinned with their own economic interests. And they don't make any bones about this. They will drop the principles of human rights when it comes to anything which threatens their economic interests. So this is a highly dubious moral position to take, given that you're finding these nations squawking the loudest about the supposed human rights violations in other nations.
Meanwhile, some of the states that are very loud in lecturing others at the UN are themselves known violators of human rights at home. Instance is Canada, which is widely criticized for its violations of the rights of its indigenous population and widespread discrimination against them. Meanwhile, Persian Gulf Arab allies of the United States are also among the states that join U.S.-led campaigns against other countries over human rights. The Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are ranked among the world's worst rights violators. Observers believe this trend needs to change if the U.S. and its allies really care about human rights around the world.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listener of Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we invite you to listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Tonight, I want to try and analyze the mechanics of the dua. What is the dua? What is the wisdom to why we make dua? And try and answer some of the theological questions that people have in their minds about how dua works in our lives. Our teachings from Rasul and the family of the Prophet, that these du'as that they have given us are there for us to realize that there can be a change in our lives. Things are set in stone by Allah. The physical rules, the physical laws are there. But in the metaphysical realm, in the spiritual world, the du'a can make a change in our own destiny. We have this hadith from the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad, ala Muhammad. In which he says, La yuruddu al-qadha illa al-du'a. That nothing can change the qadha, the fate, the destiny, illa al-du'a, except for the du'a. Again, Rasulullah is showing us that don't be content with where you're at. Some of us maybe are having financial difficulties. Just because we're in a financial difficulty, it doesn't mean that that's where we always have to be. As Rasulullah says, that your fate can change with the power of a dua. Many people who are married are looking to conceive a child. They can't conceive. They go to the fertility clinics. They get all the tests done. The woman gets tests done. The male gets all the examinations. They still can't conceive. Keep in mind this hadith, that nothing can change the qadha illa du'a. Turn to Allah, do all the examinations, the medical tests, go and get a job, go and look for a better path, a different career. But realize at the end of the day that we always have to turn back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm going to mention a couple of the challenges I want to focus on. Some of the theological, the intellectual challenges that people bring up about du'as. Is it logical to pray to a God when He knows everything? Is it not going against the happiness or the will of Allah if we ask Allah? Some people say, well, if Allah gave me X, Y, and Z, why should I make du'a? If Allah wanted to give it to me, He would have given it. I should have contentment. I should say, Allah gave it to me. I'm not going to ask for anything else. So let me try and answer some of these questions so we can better understand the way that the dua works as taught to us in the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet and his family. One of the first things that people say is that dua goes against the fact that we should always submit to Allah. Meaning that Allah put me in a particular situation, a particular income bracket, a particular family condition, and I should just have complete submission to Allah. Why do I complain to Allah? Why do I turn to Allah and complain about my situation? Why do I bother Allah with my petty issues when I should just say, Allah, you've put me in this predicament, I'll just deal with it. One of the things, or the first response that we have to understand is that dua is not just asking Allah. That dua itself is an act of ibadah, is an act of worship. Just like we make our salat every day, salat is an act of worship. Hajj is an act of worship. Paying our homes, this is an act of worship, it's an act of ibadah to Allah. In that similar way, dua is an act of ibadah. When I raise my hands to Allah on a Thursday night or a Wednesday afternoon at work after prayers, or any time of the month, any time of the day, I'm engaging in worship of Allah, ibadat. And this is what Allah expects from us. He wants us to turn to Him. He doesn't need the worship. Whatever we do, it benefits us at the end of the day. But Allah tells us in the Quran that He wants to see us worship Him. So as an example, in chapter 25, Surah Furqan, verse number 77, at the very end of the chapter, Allah says, it's a lengthy portion, just the one part of the verse, it says, Kul. So the Prophet is being told to say something to the community. And what is the message? It says, Kul, ma ya'ba'u bikum rabbi, lawla du'a'ukum. say to the community that my Lord, my Rabb, Allah, would have no care for any of you. You as human beings are insignificant. We're worthless. إِلَّا بِدُعَاءُكُمْ Except because of our du'as. There's a few different commentaries or translations of this verse. Scholars have differed of what this du'a means at the end of this verse. But one of the opinions of many of our ulama is that this relates back to du'a, to speaking to Allah, to conversing with Allah. In essence, Allah is saying that you and I have no worth with Allah unless and until we establish connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So if we don't pray our salat, we don't make dua, we just completely don't care about Allah. We're so wrapped up in the dunya and the material aspects of having fun and partying and living a secular life. We don't care about Islam or religion. The verse is saying that Allah has no care for us. We have no value, no worth, no anything in the sight of Allah. We may as well be dead, in essence. But the worth that we get, the reason that we have any worth with Allah, is not because of our bank balance. It's not because we make, you know, the 51 rakat of salat every day, the 17 wajib and 34 mustahab. It's not because we go for hajj or ziyarah or even these Muharram majalis. Our worth with Allah is our connection to Him. And if we have a connection to Allah, if we have the salat, we have dua to Allah, then we get worth. Then we have some worth in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So that's the first thing to understand, is that our essence, our worth, our value with Allah is based on our connection to Allah. The stronger, the better, the more powerful that connection becomes, the better we are in the sight of Allah. As even we see in the Quran in Surah Al-Hujarat, chapter 49, إِنَّ أَكْرَمَكُمْ إِنَّ اللَّهِ أَتْقَاكُمْ Indeed, the best of you, أَكْرَمَكُمْ, the most noblest of you with Allah, He doesn't say أَغْنَاكُمْ, the richest of you, the most beautiful of you. No, the one who have the most taqwa, the most piety, the most proximity to Allah, those are the best people with Allah. So that's point number one for tonight. We ask Allah by the right of Fatima and her husband and her father and her two sons for Allah to accept this act of worship from us tonight, to make us strong adherents to Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, and that we can have all of our du'as accepted in this world or in the next.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
IRIB English Radio.